To introduce our main speaker for this evening, Donzo from Studio City.
I'm just guessing. I'm Donzo, definitely alcoholic. How you doing? My sobriety date is October 29th, 1979. I came into AA and was sure this would not work for me. I was also pretty sure I didn't belong. So if that's going through your head, welcome. I was 22 years old, so I thought I was too young. If you feel like you're too young, welcome. I'm 54 now, and I'm still sober. So much for what I thought was going to happen. And so much for how little I thought of the program. It was huge. It went deep. It was bigger than my problem. I came from a very typical family. My dad was a minister and a poet and a radio announcer, and my mom ate. I had a brother who was 12 years older than me, and he was quite a bit shorter than me because he was a dwarf. And when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I was trying to imagine my future, and I was talking to my brother about how I wanted to be a sheriff, and I wanted to have a horse, and, you know, I wanted to have real 6 guns, not the little toy ones I was wearing. And I said to him, "What do you want to be when you grew up?" You know, and he said, "I am grown up." And I remember being profoundly changed by that moment. I suddenly felt like it wasn't okay to be me. And I'll tell you why. Because everything came easy to me. Friends came easy to me. School came easy to me. Sports came easy to me. It all came really easy to me. My brother had to work really hard to get a friend, to get somebody that wasn't just touring, see what it was like to be with a dwarf for a while. He had to work really hard to get a job because a lot of places just didn't want to have. He wanted to sell cars. And most car dealerships were like, man, the last thing we want is a dwarf. And the freaking. Finally, he got a chance to become a salesman. This one guy who was I don't know if you guys remember the show Mannix. It goes way back. If you do, you're old. Like me. But anyway, there was a guy who was he was a star of the show called Mannix, and his cousin had a car dealership, and they gave my brother a shot. They said, "We'll try you in the room." And within 2 or 3 months, everyone came to my brother first. He knew all about cars, and he told the truth about cars. Here's what's good about it. Here's what's bad about it. And they would buy cars from him. And after about 4 or 5 years, he became the number one Mercedes-Benz salesman in America, and then started to get all kinds of prizes and toys and all that kind of stuff. When he died, I was drinking quite a bit, but from the moment I got the news that he had died, and I was 20 years old, I then drank around the clock, not just daily, but daily, nightly, nonstop, until I came to AA 2 years later. I was always wound up. I was always really wound up tight, and my outlet was sports. I was a really good athlete, and I did lots of different sports, and I got a scholarship to a terrific boarding school in New Hampshire, and I went off to this boarding school in New Hampshire right after getting hit by a car. Took out both my knees. So I arrive at this boarding school unable to do sports, which is kind of what they brought me there for. So they were dying to get rid of me. I was an expensive seat in a big, expensive place. And I wasn't really, you know, doing what I was there to do. I had nervous tension that was relieved greatly by hard cider. It was what we did in the dorms. We had hard cider. You have cider, and it gets alcoholic. And if you just do it right, let it sit there in the closet, and it becomes alcoholic. If you do it wrong, it becomes vinegar, and that's a real bad drink. But hard cider will knock you on your ass, and that was a really fun one for me, so that was the thing. And then in boarding school, you can get anything, everything, and I did all those. Halloween break, I go home to my home is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, And I went to Cambridge, Massachusetts for my break and met my friends. And I brought all the goodies I got from boarding school, and they brought goodies that they had. And we had drinks and drugs and the whole nine yards. I'm 13 years old. And what they brought was the stuff that they put on top. We had a hookah. It's called a hookah. And you put wine in it, and then you put drugs inside the hookah, and then you smoke them. And on top of the drugs, they put this little stuff, and they were being very delicate about it. Sprinkle, sprinkle, sprinkle. They said, just be really easy on that stuff. So what I heard was, this is the good stuff. Dump it in. So I dumped it in and hogged the hookah long enough to completely change my brain forever. I did enough PCP to light up the city of New York. And the reason I know I'm an alcoholic is I also drank the bong wine. Hey, in case you need evidence, you drink the bong wine, you're in the right seat. You're not here by mistake. You may be wondering if you're an alcoholic. Seconded, thirded, vote, you're here. Drank the bong wine. What happened to me at the end of my PCP opium spectacular was I walked right into the center of the room and shrank. And so did everything else. And I got this real weird feeling in my body that never went away. And my heart went right from here, right up to the center of my head, and played Buddy Rich drum solos for about 3 days. Hallucinated my brains out. My parents had gone away for the weekend, and they came back to a skipping record. It was Jimi Hendrix's Band of Gypsies. And it was a certain groove. It just said, it's before CDs. And my parents said, what's up? And I said, I'm not doing well. They said, we're supposed to take you back to school. I'm not ready to go. And so instead of going back to boarding school, I went to Massachusetts General Hospital, where they wanted to find out what's gone on with Don's brain. And I couldn't shake these weird things. And so I met with all kinds of experts, and they all said, I don't know. And I went and had all these tests. I don't know. And I remember having this one guy that was an expert in PCP damage. It was one of the things he was brilliant about. And he said, I don't know. You should be dead or have killed yourself by now. Do you still feel, you know, you had me describe my symptoms. And he said, if you feel that bad, it's amazing you're here. That's all he said. His solution was to try drugs. So they tried different drugs. They ran about 50 different drugs by me and then discovered my problem was very simple. I had a Valium deficiency. Had some Valium. I was healed. It was a miracle. I went back to boarding school, and the Valium wore off. And I got the sensations back, and I remember it was snowing out, and I was walking to class, and all of a sudden I realized New Hampshire is going up instead of the snow coming down. And I started telling everybody. And they decided Don is going out. So they got rid of the guy that couldn't do sports. Went back to my hometown, started a different school where I explained to the principal that Massachusetts was going up now. Instead of, it was snowing. And he said, I think you're going back to the hospital. So I went back to the hospital. And they just said, we need to up your dose. You need to stay on this Valium stuff. So, and when I did that, it was much better. And then I discovered something, which was if I drank the stuff, and my dad had a little area where he would visit with, he was a minister, so he had this little area where he'd visit with his parishioners, and he had sherry and wine and even whiskey. And when I started doing that stuff, the Valium worked quicker, and it worked better, and it was just more fun. And then when it wore off, I could just go to that stuff, and I had a substitute for Valium. So I began as an alcoholic as a Valium substitute. It was my substitute for the relief, just to stop the weird feelings. So that's how it all began, and the way it ended was I lost a lot of different relationships and friendships and schools behind my drinking. A lot of people had a lot of problems with it. I didn't, because I felt that I was doing this medicinally. I felt that I was doing it for good reasons, and if you had my weird symptoms, you'd drink too. So they just didn't understand. And I certainly wasn't an alcoholic, because I was only doing this for preventative reasons. I had these symptoms. You know, I later read the Dr. Alcoholic Addict chapter where he said, it's not that you take drugs for certain symptoms, it's that you get certain symptoms to take certain drugs. And I later understood that much better, but had to be here a while to get it. At any rate, I woke up one day and I was now in my sixth college. I was living with a woman named Felicia who was great. She was great. She was great at helping me function. And she was terrific just because she understood about drinking. She had really, really great tools for drinking. She knew, for instance, you get drunk before the party. I didn't know that. I would go to the party to get drunk. No. You get drunk, then you go to the party, and then you keep it going. Also, you hide extra bottles in the bushes outside the party so that people don't use up your stuff. You use up their stuff, and then you go have your stuff. Stuff like that. Real simple tools, but I didn't know. You know, I didn't know. And she had a really great tool, which we later hear about in AA, which is just let go. Only what she meant was throw up. You can keep drinking if you throw up. And it's better. So I didn't know that. My whole goal when I drank was then when I get the spins and I'm nauseous and I'm just was to hold on and try to, you know, I would waste so much precious time. Because that really is our gift on life, is this time we have. That's what it says in the prayer. And it's the diamond gem, the big gift. And I would waste that time trying to hold in puke, you know, which should just go. And so she was the first one that demonstrated to me just let go. She had a little ritual. She would tie her hair back, and she would do this kind of Cub Scout salute thing, and she would get down by the toilet, and ba-boom. It was awesome. And I tried that a bunch of times, and I just couldn't do it. So she would do me, if you find a girl like that, hold on to her. That is a great friend. It's an important ally in the whole drinking business. Somebody that understands not just alcoholism and how to make it work, but understands your dilemma at not being able to let go. It's a hard one for us. I woke up one day and Felicia turned to me and, well, I'll describe my room. We had changed our room to on the floor. We had a problem, which was we would fall down. And so we just moved to the floor. We had a thing called a futon, which is Japanese for get on the floor. And we put the futon, you know, in an important place next to some chairs that were meant to be inside boats. They were little boat chairs. And they were just sat down and we could sit down there. And then if you pass out, big deal. And you fall onto the futon, life on the floor. So totally related to Gary when he was talking about the writing on the floor. Our whole life was on the floor. I woke up on this day, was the 28th of October, 1979, and it were a Sunday, and Felicia had brought in a real chair from the other room, and she was towering down over me, and I was reaching for my sherry. I had gotten a deal on some sherry, on some really cheap Christian Brothers sherry. I had cases of it, and I have one of them right next to the bed, and I would drink that, and I would take Valiums until I would stop shaking. I'd gotten the shakes pretty bad, and I had them for a couple years, actually. But I had the shakes pretty bad in the morning to where I would have to take sedatives and then drink until my nerves would steady enough so that I could, you know, get up and pee and have a normal start of the day. And she had moved all my stuff, so I'm reaching over to have my flask of pills and my sherry so I could just get to the bathroom. And it was gone, and she said, "We need to talk." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "Do you want to know what you did last night?" And the answer to that's always no. I was a blackout drinker. For anybody that's new, what that means is there's a period of time that I can't account for during every drunk. And towards the end of my drinking, I had lots of them. The beginning of my drinking, I had what they call zebra stripes. A little tiny period of time I can't. So like this part of the room, and then you can remember sort of to hear. Then no memory, and it picks up again. And used to happen first, you know, when you're driving, and all of a sudden you're, you know, 10 miles down the road, kind of a thing. And then eventually you're in Vermont, you know. And who knows? You're in one school, you're in a brand new school. You know, you've got a girlfriend, now you have a new one, that kind of thing. So blackout drinking. Felicia's saying, you want to know what you did last night? And I didn't. And she wanted to tell me. She wanted to tell me because she was upset. And the reason she was upset was that she came from this alcoholic family. And that was something she was not going to be. That was something she didn't want to be around. And she had a list. She had like a checklist for how to, you know, make sure you're not one or ever become one. And she had all these different rules for herself. And I didn't have them because I wasn't an alcoholic and wasn't going to be an alcoholic and wasn't worried about it. My family had alcoholism in it, like lots of your families do. But mine was a secret. And hers wasn't, because it was very public family, very well-known family. And there was a lot of suicides and a lot of people that hung themselves and blew their brains out and drove into cars and drove off cliffs and that kind of thing. Strokes. A lot of damage. And she understood alcoholism like really well. And she was upset because I was looking to her like I'd gotten that far. And she had decided after talking to her mother, who said, oh, move out. So she decided what I'll do is I'll have him call AA. And so she said, you need to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm 22. I'm 22 years old. And she said, you need to call AA, or I'm leaving. And, you know, it was like a Jack Benny thing. And then she said, you know, you need to call AA, or I'm leaving, and you're leaving, and we're just going to start over. And I suddenly could not picture my life, really, without her. And I couldn't picture, because she could do things. She could go out. And so, you know, that was important. She could drive. I mean, there were things that were necessary. And I called AA, fully expecting them to just say, sorry, not you, click. Instead, I got this guy, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, yeah, hey, my girlfriend said I should call. Just like that. Yeah. Well, let me get your number. We'll have somebody call you. Like that. So I didn't really want to give him my number, and Felicia gave him my number. And they hung up, and we waited. And, you know, supposedly a minute or two later, but it felt like forever, ring, ring. And I pick up the phone, and this guy goes, hey, is this Don? And I said, yeah. He goes, hey, Don, I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, oh, man, I can't help you. I got my own stuff going on. Really, don't know what to do. I just got nothing. Well, why don't you tell me about yourself, Don? Oh, well, I'm in college. I haven't been. But I'm enrolled. It's October. And tell you what, let me tell you about myself, which is what we do beautifully, right? So he's telling me about himself and his drinking, and he's talking about how he was a school teacher, and then he, you know, dropped his pants at a PTA meeting and lost his credential. And it was a different era because he got his back. He also lost his marriage while he was at it, lost his house and everything that he owned and those kinds. And I'm listening to his drinking story, and I have two different conversations going on inside my head. One is the one where I'm crying. I'm actually crying over the phone to this guy, and the other one is inside my head, and this really happened, is the part of me that's saying, shut up, stop crying, what are you doing? And then I say to Jim, the stupidest thing I've ever said to anybody, my God, I think I'm an alcoholic, which he loved. He was okay with that. I was not approving of this thing. I was very upset with myself for saying this. You're lying. What are you talking about? Alcoholic. What are you, stupid? You're 22. Shut up. Now they're going to want something from you. Don, I'd like to come pick you up and take you to a meeting. See? Right like that. And I said, I really don't, you know, and I've been crying. So I said, I've been crying. I think I'm good. You know, I had a cry. We've talked. And he said, Felicia's there? I said, yeah. He goes, put her on. So I put Felicia on, and they planned, you know, my ending. They planned it, and they made an appointment for that night. And she hangs up and she says, they're going to send a car. It'll get us at 8 o'clock. And I said, 8 o'clock? We can't be ready by 8 o'clock. It's 3. And I meant that. I started putting on all the stuff that we had in our closet. And I had a problem, which was I sweated. I used to sweat tons. And I'm putting the stuff on in my closet, these clothes, and I'm very afraid of this AA thing, and I don't know what it's going to be like. I have no picture in my head of what a meeting is like and what alcoholics are like. I just know that I'm scared to go there, and I want to wear nice dry clothes, and I keep on putting on clothes, and then I'm tanking them. I'm just tanking them, drenching everything I've got. And I'm down to like the last things I own, and for underpants I was wearing pajama bottoms that stuck out of the trousers I had, which were really humiliating. And I'm trying to tuck the pajamas under the pants, and they just looked weird. And, it was this horrible feeling of humiliation, a just total feeling of self-defeat and failure, which I later realized was such a gift. At the time, it didn't feel like a gift. A lot of our gifts that we get in recovery don't feel like gifts. They feel like the end of the world. They feel like the worst possible thing that could happen. And that's what that felt like. And then, lo and behold, knock at the door. And I go over to open the door. And there's this guy carrying a thing of oxygen. He has, tubes up his nose. He's got a little hunchback. And he's breathing like that. And I close the door. And I said, Felicia, it's for you. And I went off to the bedroom. I was not interested in seeing that guy. He scared me. And they coaxed me out to the sober mobile. And I go out there, and there is a world of trouble waiting for me. And Felicia and I go out to get in this car just to go to a meeting. And in that car were all these people that didn't want to go to an AA meeting, but this guy who ran a halfway house had gotten them to get into his car. And his sponsor had this edict, that's God's car, it's not your car. Full car, Lloyd. So old Lloyd had, gotten these people into the car. And to me, they looked like really scary people. I was very, very frightened of everybody there. And that's just me being afraid, but I didn't want to get in that car by myself. And I said to Felicia, this looks really creepy to me, and I don't want to go to the meeting unless you get in the car. She goes, I don't need to get in the car. I'm not the alcoholic. I know, but I'm not going to get in the car unless you get in the car. And she goes, okay. So she gets in the front seat. I get in the back seat, and I'm next to two little people. And these are not dwarfs. They're midgets. They're just little people. And they were identical twins. And they smelled like booze. They had clearly just been drinking if they weren't drinking now. And I said, hi, you guys been to AA? And oh, yeah, I hate AA. I just hope nobody cries tonight. Like that. And his little twin brother had the same laugh. And then the guy who was sitting next to Felicia in the front had a cast in his finger. He turns around to see what's going on. Off we go. We get to this big church basement in Mount Tabor, Oregon. And all these people are there. None of them look like the people in my car. Because I had the little people and then this woman that kind of looked Frankensteinish, kind of gray skin. And the guy with the cast and then old Lloyd, and then Felicia, and it was just nobody like that in the whole meeting. Everybody else just looked like you. They looked fine. I'm thinking, why was my car, that car? What's wrong with me? I sit down next to a guy. He had a Budweiser shirt and he had a marijuana shirt and a Budweiser cap is what it was. And I thought that was a bold move for an AA meeting. And the guy turns to me just as the meeting's about to start. All the people go off to different rooms. They went to Alatot and Alatine and men's group and step thing and women's group and everything. They had, everything but Alapet. And then the group that was just going to be in the middle was the open meeting where I was, and I sat down next to this guy, and this guy with the Budweiser cap turns to me and goes, hey, you don't have to give your real name. And then the meeting starts, and they start going around saying their names. And I'm thinking, okay, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. Am I not supposed to have my name? Am I supposed to have an anonymous name? Is everybody saying, a different name? Very confusing. And it came to me, and I was like, I just was out of ideas. And I said, I'm Don. I'm an alcoholic. And I remember feeling like I just lied. No, I'm not an alcoholic. What did I say that for? Now they're going to believe I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not an alcoholic. I don't belong here. I'm too crazy to be here. There's nobody else here that's got my story. And then people are getting up to the podiums, and they're telling their little tales, and I'm listening at them. I'm listening for what's different. I'm listening for why I don't belong here. And I'm finding evidence. There's lots of things. If you want to find evidence, it's there. There's lots of things. You can always find the difference. It was easy. It was really easy. Until I got the last speaker, the guy had my name. His name was Don. And he was getting up there because he said this was 10 years for him. He's 10 years sober. And this is his first outside meeting. It was a church basement. I was a little confused. And he explained that, he loved to drink and drive. And he's describing drinking and driving, and I'm thinking, I love to drink and drive. Drinking and driving is where it all began for me. I loved the feeling. In fact, one of the things I loved about moving from Boston to Oregon was, you know, they have the slick streets, especially when during an ice storm, you could just lightly tap the brakes and spin around. And you could really feel a drunk. And I loved that. I even enjoyed having accidents. And the consequences, no, but I liked the feeling of having an accident. That kind of bumper car thing I had was satisfying. He's telling his story, and he's explaining he's a blackout drinker, and my first time hearing the term, and so I asked the person next to me, so it's a period of time where you don't remember, you know, what happened. And I'm thinking, doesn't everybody have that? Isn't that what happens to anybody who drinks? It's what happened to me as soon as I drank. Huh. And so there's a special term for it. So now I'm a special category alcoholic. And he's talking about drinking and driving. He's talking about blackouts. And then he talks about how in his last blackout, he has no recollection of what happened, but apparently he drove through an intersection and killed a family who was walking with their stroller. And he went to prison, and he was now going to spend the rest of his life trying to make amends for that. And he said, and of course I can't. I can't make amends for taking someone's life, for taking their family away. I can't. And he says, but I will do the best I can to be a very different human being and to try to have a different effect on the world. And the way he said this is different from how I'm saying it. It's not my story. That's his story. And when he got done telling his story, the entire meeting was sobbing. And we get into the Sadmobile to go home. And the two people next to me are really pissed off that somebody had crying again tonight. And then Amy. An old Lloyd who's driving starts working the room, and he's passing books out, and he says, this is our basic text. Read it through, and then study it like a textbook. And he says, these are all left at the halfway house from people that decided they would rather drink than be here. So if you all of a sudden decide you'd rather drink than be here, then please give this book either to me or to somebody else who might need it. And he's handing these books, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to read this book. And then he hands out a thing called the 20 questions. And he says, this is 20 questions. Just take this when you get home. It'll help you settle in. And we get to our house, and he says, okay, we'll come by tomorrow night to get you. And Felicia and I said simultaneously, no! And he said, see you tomorrow. Off he goes. We get in the house, and I sat down and took the 20 questions so that I could just be done with this thing. Did really well on the 20 questions. So I take the 20 questions, and I did really well, and there's Felicia going to the kitchen. I said, where are you going? She goes, I'm going to go get a beer. I said, well, aren't you going to take the 20 questions? No, I'm not an alcoholic. Well, if you're not an alcoholic, then why don't you take 20 questions? Well, I want to have a beer. Yeah, but if you're not an alcoholic, you don't need to have the beer. You might as well just do the 20 questions to shut me up. And on it goes, ping pong. And she finally says, you're not going to leave me alone until I take the 20 questions. And I said, right. So she said, okay. So she sits down, and she's taking a long time. Because, you know, her alcoholist family has got this, you know, the dominoes, the suicides, the terrible stories. And she looks at these questions differently from the way I looked at these questions. Because to me, I'm a tourist. I was just visiting out of curiosity, and I've done this thing so that I don't have to get kicked out, and now I'm done, is how I feel about it. Her turn. And so she's taking these, and finally, we've been there a long time, and she's finished, she stopped writing, and she just has this look in her face, blank. And I said, well, how did you do? She goes, I don't know, 16? I said, whoa, you want to know how the scoring works? No. I can read it myself. And she turns it over and just stares at it. And, you know, I'd already read the score. It said if you had one of these things, you might be an alcoholic. Two, probably. Three, you're screwed, right? And so she had 16, which she later admitted was with waffling. And so she's staring at this thing and has this now kind of horrible expression on her face, just, you know, kind of like that. So now I imitate the meeting we just been through. I go, hey, Felicia, I'm Don. I'm an alcoholic. For a while. And finally I said to her, hey, Felicia, I'm Don. I'm an alcoholic. And she goes, I'm Felicia. I'm an alcoholic. Like that. I was like, yes. I didn't want to go to meetings alone. I'm going to do this. I want to be by myself in that car. We go to meetings all around, and Felicia, because of her understanding of alcoholism, she jumps right in. She gets a sponsor. She's reading the book. She's quoting the book. She's having drunk dreams and talking about it at the meetings. And these meetings are like, this is 1979, rural Oregon, mostly guys. They're calling on her 2-3 times. And they love her, Cheryl. Good stuff, Felicia. And they all gave us their numbers, and they all said, you know, put the plug in the jug and thing in your ears and da-da-da-ding. And I'm not liking any of these people, except for this one guy who's kind of a weird guy, big guy, and he would go. Whenever he'd see me, I'd thank you. And so we go to these different meetings, and we go home, and I start a fight with Felicia so we could feel better. And I'd pick a fight with Felicia about whatever it was I could think of. And then she'd go, you know what? I'm going to call my sponsor. This is how I found out she had a sponsor. I'm going to call my sponsor. I said, you're what? She goes, I'm going to call my sponsor. She gets on the phone, and she's calling some lady. La, 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 la. And now she's reading the book over the phone. And I'm thinking, I'm 22 years old. My girlfriend can't even have a fight with me. So we go to a meeting, and same scenario. And I thought, man, I'm going to get a sponsor. So that guy. I walked up to him, and I said, would you be my sponsor?
I'd be honored to be your sponsor. Here's my number. Call it.
So we get home, and I start a fight with Felicia. And very short time, she says, you know, I'm going to call my sponsor. I said, I'm going to call my sponsor. And I called him up. And I said, hey, let me tell you how this is going. This Felicia's doing this, and she's saying that. Da 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 da. And he goes, hey, shut up. Just like that. Do you know you've got a disease that will kill you and all this kind of thing? And I'm like, I don't know. And you want to die? And he says, get out your book. And so I'm getting out the book, and I'm reading the book with a guy who got kicked off the police force over the telephone, thinking, I'm 22 years old. I just want to have a fight with my girlfriend so that I can drink. And I'm talking to a guy that can't even be a cop. And I thought, it's over. My life is over. And at the end of our conversation, the worst possible thing happened, which was I felt better. It's the worst possible thing that could happen. Because when we got done talking, I didn't want to drink. I wanted to get to a meeting. And I called him back. And he said, you need a prayer for the morning. He says, when you wake up, you're going to probably feel bad. So you need to thank God for the day. He says, say to God, thank you for today sober. He goes, can you do that? I went, yeah, I guess so. And he goes, yeah. But make it an honest prayer. I said, what? He goes, say, thank you for today sober. And help me to mean it, because I don't. He says, that sound honest? I said, yeah, that sounds honest. He goes, where are you at with God? I said, I'm nowhere with God. I'm not interested. He goes, oh, let's add something. And help me to believe in you, because I don't. Tap that on. Can you do that? Yeah, okay. And I hung up, and I had a horrible night. I had a horrible night of weird things and drunken dreams and all the stuff that Felicia's been having. And I woke up really trembly, and I woke up really scared, and I woke up scared that I wouldn't be able to do this. And I prayed, God, thank you for today. Help me to mean it, because I don't. And help me to believe in you, because I don't. And I had a huge hallucination where I saw a church steeple on fire and it was all coming down on me. And anyway, I got rushed to a hospital and went into seizures and all that. And I got to this nut ward, which is a terrible place to put someone who's tense. And had a roommate who would part his hair really carefully. And I never found out what his name was. And he would get it all just right, and then he would mess it up and go the other way. Just nonstop. That was my roommate. And I was there just having, you know, really weird sensations and really weird stuff starting to come up, that stuff that I'd taken Valium and drinking to stop. And I hallucinated the rest of my first year of sobriety. And they used to bring meetings to me. And they'd bring in a little panel. I guess they call it the hallucinating guy meeting. And must have been the worst meeting in Oregon. And I got to tell you, you know, they asked me, would I be willing to be taped? And I'm thinking, absolutely. I'd be willing in any way possible to reach anybody anywhere who's desperate for sobriety. Because I was. Because here's what I got instead. When the panel would go, I'm left there with medical help. And the nurse would come in and say, are you sure you don't want me to shoot you up? No, I'm not sure I don't want you to shoot me up. And I went off to see a brain specialist to find out, you know, what happened to Don's brain, version number 2. And he said, well, you've damaged your neural receptors with PCP so bad that you're going to be hallucinating the rest of your life. Expect to be a mental patient. Keep your expectations low. Have a nice day. So the panel came in after I had that report. And I told the panel, it was a guy named Cookie, a black guy named Cookie who was always really funny and really inspirational. And I was just looking at Cookie like, man, it's not going to work today. And Cookie said, why, what's the matter? You look much worse than usual. And I said, the doctor said I'm going to be a mental patient the rest of my life, keep my expectations low, I'm always going to be hallucinating. He goes, oh, what do they know? They're doctors. He goes, we got hallucinating guys, don't we, Bob? And Bob goes, yeah, we got hallucinating guys. And they brought him in, started bringing in all the hallucinating guys, tell their stories, fantastic stories, talking tuna fish, smoke coming out of the nurse, it was great. One of the guys they brought in was named Owen, and Owen had 15 years of sobriety, drank, and now had 15 years again, and he was not going to lose it this time. This time he was going to stick around, and the way he did it was to work the program thoroughly and especially live in the 12th step, practicing all the principles, carrying the message. So he said, We need to take you to a quiet place, to get you down to the quiet place. I said, the quiet place? What are you, nuts? Absolutely. Absolutely. And that magic that we have, that only you can give to another alcoholic, is saying, I absolutely know what it's like to do that. I absolutely know what it's like to feel that way. I absolutely know what it's like to lose everything. And here's a guy that he knew what it was like to hallucinate. He hadn't done PCP. He was a schizophrenic. He's like, I can beat your hallucinations for a long shot. I come in as a whole different person sometimes. And he did. Fantastic guy. And he took me through this guided meditation and talked about being in the palm of God's hand. And after about 3 hours of it, I felt like I was in the palm of God's hand. Amazing. Didn't stop the hallucinations, but I felt calm for the first time. And he says, good, now we need to carry this message. I said, I don't have a message. What message? He goes, well, yeah, you will. And so he brings in his sponsee, Flappin' Tony. And Flappin' Tony always had he had the shakes nonstop, and he always had 3 days. How you doing, Tony? Pretty good, 3 days. So he said, we're going to go on a 12-step call. A good one. And we went off to this trailer park, and we're going to get this guy and take him to a meeting. And we went off to this trailer park in rural Oregon, beautiful little trailer park. Pretty little candles in the windows and things. And then there's this one kind of messed up trailer, sort of on a tilt, kind of rusted out. And Owen says, oh, that's our guy. How do you know? Oh, he called. We talked. So I'm with Tony, and Tony is kind of leaning on me, and I'm hallucinating, so I can't really figure out where anything is. And I'm holding on to Tony, and we're walking to the trailer. And we get up there, and Owen knocks on the door, and we hear inside, brrr, boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom. And he opens the door, and the smell hit us. This is smell, you know, sort of this bridge on the River Kwai, horrible heat and smell coming out of this thing. And he shines his little pen light in there. And Owen got his pen light right in the middle of this pile of life on life's terms. And in the middle of it is this big, naked, pink man in the little spotlight of his pen light. And he just looks up at us and says, "I messed up." And Owen says, "Yeah, you did. Okay, guys, go get him dressed." And I hated Owen. I had loved him the day before, and now I hated him. And I didn't want to go in that place. This trailer has had this whole guy's life all messed up and in pieces. And there was no clean clothing to put on this guy. And he was naked, and he smelled bad, and he's farting. And it was gross, and I'm angry. And Tony's flapping all over me. And we're getting clothes to stick on the guy, and I'm hating him. And we get in the car, Owen's little car, where he had the seat next to him in the front seat was piles of books. And we had to all sit in the back. And flapping Tony here, and the big guy, pink guy there in the middle. And then I was in the other corner. And the pink guys were driving off, just starts burping. And farting. And burbling. And then he doesn't feel well. Bluey. Tony's flying now. And Owen is digging it. And Owen's deal was he liked to go to the really calm suburban meetings out there. Where, oh, yes, live in those little meetings. And just bring alcoholics and say, "There, deal with that." We were his posse tonight. The hallucinating guy, flapping guy, and the big pink barfing guy. And Owen loved it. Then the guy, the big pink man, goes into seizures and starts banging out the back of Owen's car, his head against the window. And Owen goes, "Oh, dear." And we found a little emergency room, and we got out, and we got him into the emergency room, and the nurse doesn't want to take him. She has all the reasons why we can't come. And Owen, who's a big man, grabbed the nurse and said, "I'm leaving him." And she goes, "Oh, yeah, good. That's a good idea. It's a hospital." And so we're leaving, and Owen's pitching us now about what's happening. He says, "Now, this is why we do the 12-step call. Well, only alcoholics care about the alcoholics. Obviously, they don't care about us. And only we care that we live or die." And we're driving on about another 10 feet, and Tony says to me, "Do you care if he lives or dies?" And I said, "Well, I hope he dies. I think it'd be better for the whole world." We get to Tony's place and drop him off. We go to my nut ward to drop me off. And Owen wants to come in and debrief. And he says, "How was your 12-step call? How was your first 12-step call?" And I said, "I hated it. I hated my first 12-step call." And I start making up swears. I'm inventing. I'm overlapping swears for him. And he says to me, "How were your hallucinations the past 3 hours?" I said, "What? How were your hallucinations? You said all you wanted was to stop hallucinating. How were they?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't thinking about it." He goes, "Hey, that's AA. Welcome. Now you can have yourself all night long." And he left. And as soon as he left, I was hallucinating all night long. And I was by myself. And I couldn't wait to have him back. And it's how this thing works. It's how it starts. It starts with the magic of one person. And every person here has magic in them. And we can give that magic to other people. We can share it. And we can get out of our own stuff, whatever our stuff is. Even if it's not creepy. Even if it's just itchy desire to get more adrenaline going. No matter what it may be, we can get out of that and get into somebody else's life a little bit and do some good. It's the program. It's worked for me for almost 32 years. I got 3 kids, never seen me drink. I've gone through horrible things like 20 years of marriage and then having a divorce and it felt like the bottom fell out of my entire vehicle. I had a sponsor that I just loved more than anybody in the world and he died. So did my father. So did my dog. And I was a dog trainer before I became a school teacher. And dogs were everything to me and my dog was amazing. And he's gone. And I had something that could hold me through the little things of life. If I hadn't had you, I'd be out there. I'd be dead or drinking. No question in my mind. Because I'm not bigger than alcoholism, but we are. God comes into us, not into me. So thank God for you. You've given me a good long life so far, sober. Thank you.